Thank you, worship team, for leading us in a wonderful time of worship, time of reflection on what God means to us, what He has accomplished for us, and what He intends to do in the future for us. Music has a way of just drawing us closer to the Lord, doesn't it? It's a beautiful Sabbath day, isn't it? Another gift from God. And to be here with our family, friends, the church family, is a wonderful experience. For those of you that are visiting this morning, we've been studying the book of Matthew, and more specifically, the last few months, we have been studying the suffering of Christ. It hasn't really been until I reached this point in our study that I began to wrestle and struggle with the content of chapter 26. I guess up to this point, we've sort of been looking at the life of Jesus, observing the life of Jesus, looking at His teachings and those that surrounded Him and the people that surrounded His ministry, the dynamics that were taking place in the culture of that time and in the religion of that time, the politics, and all the things that come with living here on this world. But it hasn't really struck me until I reached this point in the life of Jesus. It hasn't really struck me how much involved I really am in this whole thing. It's okay to look at something that happened 2,000 years ago and kind of look at it through a microscope or a telescope or however you want to put that and say, oh yeah, those people back then, you know, they were really crazy. They were really bad people, you know, sinful people. But then as I got to this part of chapter 26, where Jesus is in the garden and there He is being weighed down by the sins of the world. He is being torn apart by my sins and your sins. There as He is laying His face on that damp, cold rock and His hands grasp that rock, and as the sweat comes down His face and drips onto that rock, and that sweat in heavy drops even has blood in it, I realize the agony that Christ suffered there in the garden was one that was from the very depths of His soul. And that I was very much a part of the burden that Jesus carried there in the garden of Gethsemane. And as I have continued on in my study, I guess I have to admit that I feel more and more responsible for the suffering of Jesus. Because as I read the rest of the story, and you can follow along this morning if you would like, Jesus is there in the garden and He hears the mob, the crowd that's coming to take Him away along with Judas, and He goes forth to meet them. And as they make their way through the shrubbery and they're cracking the snapping of twigs and the voices, the muffled voices, and you can see the torches and he can see the anger on the faces of those that are coming to take Him away. Jesus had a choice. Actually, He had more than one choice. There were many things He could have done. He could have turned and run. I wonder how many of us would have done that. He could have called 10,000 angels or more and ended the whole thing. But He was determined to carry out the covenant that He had made. He was determined to carry out the plan of salvation for you and for me. And because of that, He stood and faced those who were about to take His life from Him. And so it's here in chapter 26, beginning with verse 47. While He was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived with Him with a large crowd, armed with swords and clubs, and they were sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him. Going to at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed Him. Of course, those who had come with Judas grabbed Jesus and tied him up like some kind of a criminal. They bound his hands. They hobbled his feet. They wrapped ropes around him, and they drug him along the path that he had just crossed not too long before, back to Jerusalem. This time Jesus was bound by those he came to save. He was tied up, and he was cursed upon and spat upon. And as they made their way towards Jerusalem, the crowd grew bigger and bigger. You can imagine they could hear the shouting and the curses. And so people were curious. And so they came along to join the crowd. And the crowd got larger. And by the time they reached the palace of Annas, they were a large crowd, a noisy crowd, a hideous crowd. And as I reflected upon that scene, that crowd of people moving towards Jerusalem, I couldn't help but think that along with that crowd were invisible angels. Those angels that so many times before had come to the rescue of Jesus, they'd hidden him from the crowds. Those angels that had held his head in their lap and comforted him there in the wilderness. The same angels who were there with him in the Garden of Gethsemane as he agonized over the coming death, the cross. Those same angels were traveling along by the legions. And the only thing that kept them from doing what they had done so many times before was the very hand of God, who restrained them and held them back and kept them from going to the rescue of their great leader, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As I reflected a little more on this particular scene here of that crowd dragging Jesus along, stumbling and tripping and falling and picking him up and yelling and cursing and spitting and hitting him, I thought to myself, here were those that Jesus had been a friend of. Here were those who he came to save, and now they had shackled him. They had bound his hands and his feet. And now they were taking him before sinful men to be judged, to be sentenced. The Holy One of Israel, the Lamb of God, the lover of our souls. So they arrived. It's interesting, you know, if you study the Gospels, you will notice that where one Gospel writer doesn't give a whole lot of detail, the other one does. And so I had to go and study some of the other Gospels to kind of fill in some of the pieces that Matthew just didn't record. And I came across something that was astonishing. I know that I had read these passages many, many times before, but it suddenly struck me that Jesus was tried 6 times in one night. He was already tired. He was already beaten down. He was already emotionally stressed out, and they dread him now before Annas, who was, well, he was the father-in-law of the high priest. You say, well, why him? Wasn't Jesus to be tried before the high priest and the rulers, the religious rulers of the time? Well, yes, according to Jewish law, that was supposed to be what would happen. But they bring him before Annas, and it's interesting because, as I said, Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, and Caiaphas was the high priest. So why did they take him first to the father-in-law? He was not the ruling high priest. He was not the appointed one to be the judge. Well, we have to go back and understand and remember something. The house of Annas and Caiaphas were the ruling class of the Jewish nation. They were not only the religious leaders, but they had the control, the power over the people because of the temple. Well, okay. They had a theocracy going there. Why was that such a big deal? Well, it's like this. The temple was the center. It was the hub of all the life of the Jewish nation. People came from many distant countries. People from all around the world came to the temple, Solomon's temple, to worship, because that was the place to be. Ah, but what was next door? What was next door to that great, grand, and glorious temple of God? A huge, elaborate, well, there were factories. Next door was a place where the sheep that were brought to be offered at the temple were butchered and sold in the marketplace to make money. The skins were used to sell and make money. The wool was used to sell and make money. Do you get the picture? And all of the money that was made off of this business was given to the high priest. And the high priest became very wealthy. So when Jesus came into the temple and cleansed the temple and said, "You have made this place like a marketplace where you do business. Get out of my Father's house." What was he doing? He was destroying the economy or the business of the high priest's family. They were losing money because of Jesus. And they didn't like that. And so Annas, being the father-in-law, being the patriarch of the group, absolutely hated Jesus. He feared Jesus. He was afraid of what Jesus might do to his pocketbook. He was afraid of what Jesus was going to do to his businesses that he owned. By the way, even the blood that came from the sacrifices in the temple ran down into a brook that ran down into the valley into a pond where it coagulated on the top of the water, and the farmers in the local towns would come and draw that blood off the top after it was coagulated and use it as fertilizer, and they taxed them for that. So you understand, you get the picture what's happening here? Jesus was absolutely the worst enemy of the family of the high priest. And all the priests, for that matter, in Jerusalem, because they all got their money under the table. They all got their payoff for keeping silent. And so he's brought before the father-in-law, the high priest. It doesn't say a whole lot about that particular session. But as we continue on, we see that he's brought then to Caiaphas. Caiaphas, of course, being the high priest. And as he stands before Caiaphas, of course, around him, around Caiaphas, are the rulers, the religious rulers, the priests, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, those that are in the higher echelons of the ruling group of Jerusalem. And they've come out at night. And I think it's important and significant to realize that this was not something that just happened. To get all of these people out at night, especially, would have taken a very serious act by the high priest and his family to demand that these people come out at night to have a trial, to have a court case. And so they all come out. Well, not all of them. Later on we find out that Nicodemus and a few others weren't there. But at least the ones who followed and listened to the leading and the words of the high priest were there. And so we follow this story, and there were people that were brought in to give testimony. Verse 59, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they not find any. They couldn't find any witnesses that could agree, and their stories were not accurate. But then they finally find some. And they have them come forward. Two of them came forward. Imagine that. Two witnesses. They come forward and declare. And this is what they said about Jesus. This fellow said, "I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days." Now, do you remember that story? Jesus was up there on the hill overlooking the beautiful temple of Solomon. And he made this statement, that I am able to destroy. And then, of course, these witnesses totally twisted his words. Jesus was talking about himself. He was talking about his soon death and resurrection. But they took it literally and they said, you see, this man is blaspheming. He says he will destroy the temple and he can raise it up again. And that was blasphemy. But Jesus wouldn't respond. And they asked him to respond. The high priest. So then the high priest stood up and he said, I charge you under the oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. They made Jesus swear by his own father to tell the truth. Well, you know Jesus is not going to stay silent for that for a minute. And what is his response? You can read it. Verse 64. Yes? Yes, it is as you say. I didn't say it. You said it. Oh, absolutely the worst thing he could have said. They became so angry. But it's interesting because Jesus continues. But I say to all of you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. Okay, now wait a minute. Get the picture. This is a guy that they picked up in the Garden of Gethsemane. They tied him up. They literally hog-tied him. They drug him in before Caiaphas. And he's all bloodied and he's all covered with sweat. And he's got these ropes that are tying his arms and his legs. And he's standing there. He doesn't look like a king, does he? No king would allow something like that to happen. Now, where are his followers? Where are those who have vowed to protect him? Those who have vowed to make sure that he's safe and kept out of harm's way? Where have they gone? Jesus stands alone in this crowd of rabbles, this crowd of people who seek to destroy him. He stands alone and he claims that he will come again in the clouds of heaven, and they will see him coming in the clouds of heaven. He proclaims himself to be the Son of God. And he would also be at the right hand of the Mighty One, coming in the clouds of heaven. Well, what follows is an interesting insight into the mindset of the religious leaders of that time. They had totally lost their sense of who they were and who they were serving and who they were worshiping. And Caiaphas, the high priest, the one who wore this beautiful, beautiful robe that was all made in one piece, symbolizing the oneness and the unity with God, symbolizing holiness, symbolizing all of the things that God wanted Israel to be. As he stood there, he became so enraged at Jesus, so angered by what Jesus had said, that he took that robe that was made of one piece and he tore it, he rent it. Wow. Do you know what the punishment for tearing the priestly robes is? The symbolism of the priesthood and the robes were so important. They were so precious and so holy and so sanctified that to tarnish it or to tear it or to damage it in any way was considered a serious offense. But then to personally tear it meant that you were signifying that this was the end of your service as a high priest. He was so caught up in the anger and the rage. He was so caught up with the demonic mindset that was going on in that place in that time that he lost control and he actually ended his own personal priestly ministry by tearing that robe. Interesting. His ministry as a high priest was going to end anyways, because it was going to be replaced by the true high priest, Jesus Christ. It's significant that Caiaphas condemned himself. He ended his own priestly ministry here on this earth, that ministry that was supposed to symbolize the divine ministry of Christ in heaven. He tore his own robes. He ended his own ministry so that Christ could pick up and take over where he left off. Isn't that wonderful? Little did he know. The high priest, it says in verse 65, tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look now, you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" I want you to hang on to that question just a little longer. What do you think? Here was a man bound by ropes. Here was a man helpless, standing before the leaders and the rulers of Israel, and he claims to be the Son of God. He claims to have the power of God, and he claims he's coming back as a king. What do you think? That's an interesting question. But the trial isn't over. You see, these men's minds were so twisted. They were not allowed by Roman law to condemn a criminal. They were not allowed even to judge. They were not even allowed to have a trial without the permission of Rome. So they realize they've got to move on. And so from Caiaphas' court case here and from his courtyard, they move then, of course, on to Pilate. Now, who's Pilate? Pilate is a Roman governor. He's a heathen Roman governor. And he is there, he's appointed by Rome to make sure that peace is kept, to make sure that there are no uprisings, that nobody tries to overthrow the Roman garrisons. He is there to sort of collect the taxes and do all the other things that he's sort of a puppet, I guess you would say, of the Roman government. And so we have Jesus that he goes on to Pilate's courtroom. It's interesting that these holy men of God, these righteous holy men of God, these high priests, these men who were to represent the God that Jesus came to reveal, wouldn't set foot in Pilate's courtyard. They wanted nothing to do with going in there because Pilate was unholy. It was unholy ground, you see, and they wanted nothing to do with that. So they send people in to represent them. These rabble-rousers, these people who are being paid to say terrible things about Jesus. These false witnesses. And they are brought before. They are brought before Pilate. Well, Pilate was a man who really was not concerned about who Jesus was. He had many people that came to his court and were tried and convicted of treason and other things, and they were sentenced to death. But there's something about Jesus. There's something about the way Jesus carries himself. Pilate's not sure. He's not quite sure who this man is, and so he talks to Jesus. Now, of course, I'm getting some of this from the other Gospels. But he talks to Jesus, and Jesus, following his typical demeanor, was not really giving him answers that satisfied him. And it's while he is asking these questions that is recorded for us the fact that that he receives a message from his wife, who had a dream, and in that dream she saw Jesus, and she was convicted that Jesus was who he claimed to be, and she said, sent a messenger to Pilate and said, "Don't have anything to do with this. Do not have anything to do with this." Well, probably like most men, he didn't really listen to his wife, did he? And he proceeds on. And Jesus is tried. Now, the six times, and I'll just go over this quickly with you, is he went first to Annas, then he went to Caiaphas, then he went to the Sanhedrin to be judged by the Sanhedrin, then he went to the governor Pilate, and then he was taken to King Herod. And then from King Herod, he was brought back to Pilate. Six times. Terrible. For anybody to even go. Have you ever been to court before? Y'all going, "No, I'm not going to tell you that." I have. I may have told the story before. Many years ago, before I was married to my wife. And I was in L.A. with a gospel singing group and didn't know the town very well. And I was driving the van full of equipment for the concert that we were headed to. And there's a sign, as clear as day, but when you don't know the town, you're not looking at signs. You're looking at traffic and you're looking at other things. And it said, right turn only. And I made a left turn. And there was a nice little motorcycle cop there that pulled me over. And so I received a ticket. And in the hustle and the bustle of that experience, I tucked the ticket away in my wallet and got on the airplane and flew over to Hawaii. And while I was in Hawaii, and I was there for, I believe, a couple of months, I had forgotten to call the courthouse and tell them. So when I got back, I realized that I had a warrant out for my arrest. Okay, so I defied the courts, not intentionally, you see. And so when I had to stand before the judge, I was guilty. I knew I was guilty. There's no question I was guilty. I knew that they could arrest me right there at that moment in the courthouse and take me off to prison for defying the courts and also not following up on my bail or following up on my ticket. And so in my and there were people before me that were going before the judge, and he had this stern look on his face, and he was sentencing them this and that and for this and, you know, all kinds of things. And I was getting scared, more and more scared. I was scooting down in my seat. When he called my name, my hands were sweating, and I couldn't hardly breathe, and I was choking on my own saliva. And I got up front, and he says, well, and he looks at this, and he goes, well, oh, I see, okay, a warrant. Oh, he reads it out, and all the people are looking at me, and I said, sir, can I say something? He said, sure, say it. What do you have to say for yourself, son? And I said, well, sir, I am guilty. He goes, yes, you are. I said, sir, I didn't intentionally ignore the courts. I was traveling, and I was in Hawaii when the second warning came, and I forgot about it. And I'm here to receive whatever judgment you place on me. I am guilty. And he took his glasses and put them on the end of his nose, and he looked at me, and he says, you're an interesting young man. He says, what did you say you were doing? I said, well, sir, I'm a member of a gospel singing group that travels around the country. And, sir, I'm sorry. I did not mean to break the law. He says, you know, I believe you. He says, I do. It sounds odd, but I believe you. He says, just pay the original ticket and you're free. I've never felt so much relief in all my life. But you see, here is Jesus. He is innocent. I was guilty. He is innocent. He is standing before the courts of this world, and he is being tried, and false testimonies are being given, and he is being condemned for something he is not even guilty of. There's a lot of things. I made a little list. Actually, I borrowed a list from a commentary. But there's an interesting list of things that were problems in the arraignment, the arrest, the arraignment, and the trial of Jesus. Let me just list them for you here. It gets interesting. The Sanhedrin was designed to save the life, not take it away. Okay? Yet these men, they've gathered for the sole purpose of putting Jesus to death. The trial was conducted at night, and by Jewish law, it specifies clearly that all trials were to be held only during the daytime. Okay? Count two. The third, the accused was always allowed to call witnesses in defense of himself, and Jesus was not given the privilege of calling a single witness to testify. And boy, could he have done that. Think of the thousands of people that he fed. Think of the miracles that he performed. People who received their eyesight. Lazarus, who only lived a few blocks away, could have come and testified about being resurrected from the dead. The list goes on and on and on. Jesus could have called thousands of witnesses, but he was not allowed. This was a kangaroo court. He was not allowed to have witnesses. The Sanhedrin was to judge the case, not prosecute it. And in the trial of Jesus, they assumed both roles. If any witnesses were found to have given false testimony before the court, they would be given the same punishment being sought for the accused. Whoa. Those of you that are familiar with the judicial system will see some interesting parallels to our own judicial system here in America. protects the innocent. If the death penalty was being sought, the Sanhedrin was required to observe a three-day waiting period of prayer. Listen to this, prayer and fasting before judgment was rendered. Jesus was tried, convicted, and dead before 24 hours had passed away. The Sanhedrin could not condemn anybody to death on a unanimous vote. Listen to this. A unanimous vote for condemnation suggested that the element of mercy was missing. Yet, Jesus was condemned. Trials were only to be held within the temple. And it was illegal to bribe witnesses to give false testimony. It was against the law. Now this one is significant. It was against the law to force a prisoner to testify against himself. Interesting, isn't it? They defied every single one of those laws that they themselves were to be held accountable to. And so Jesus was accused. He was lied about. He was drugged before a kangaroo court, bound. He was condemned. And I guess this is the point. As I look at this trial, these trials, I realize that this is a picture of the hideousness of humanity who's following Satan. This is how bad it gets when people are willing to take someone who is innocent and treat them the way they treated Jesus. Willing to lie about him, willing to bring false testimonies, willing to condemn an innocent man. This is the epitome. This is the classic behavior of men and women who are not controlled by the power of God and the Holy Spirit. These are men and women that are controlled by Satan and his little demons. Jesus was condemned by those that he came to save. Even though what we have discussed this far seems hideous, and I'm not going to get into all the gory details of how they treated Jesus. You don't need to stretch your imagination very far to realize that people who are being controlled by demonic powers, what they are capable of doing. We see it, the evidence of that in this world all the time. And those of you that saw the movie The Passion probably still have visuals of that movie. And you know how Jesus was beaten. He was whipped. He was spat upon. By the way, it was not allowed to spit within the confines of the temple. And yet they did that. When they were in Caiaphas' courtyard, they spat upon Jesus. It was considered to be unclean. It was disgusting. And yet they did that. We don't need to go into the gory details of how Jesus' blood was shed for us, how his body was torn apart and ripped by the whips of the Roman soldiers. Because one of the greatest tragedies of this experience, the greatest tragedies of this trial, was when Peter betrayed his Lord. The one that had vowed to protect his Lord, the one that had vowed to defend him with a sword. That's the tragedy of this trial. That's the heartbreak of this time, this period in Jesus' life. That made him suffer more than anything else. And I guess when I read about Peter, it just comes too close to home. When I read about, here's a man who followed Jesus, who considered himself the closest friend of Jesus, the one who promised to protect him regardless of what happened. And yet, when the finger was pointed at him, when he was asked if he was a follower of Jesus, he denied his Lord. Not just once. Not twice. Three times. Three times he denied Jesus. And I got to reflecting about my own life and wondering, how many times have I denied the Lord? And I began to realize that Peter was a pretty good guy. Yeah. Peter was a pretty good guy compared to me. I began to realize that there are so many ways and so many times in my life when I had the opportunity to stand up and defend my Lord when I just waffled. When people are coming to me, yes, maybe laughing at times. Some of the guys that I hang around with don't want anything to do with Christianity or the Lord. And there have been times when my silence was a denial of my Lord. And I realized that down in the depths of my heart, in reality, I'm a Peter. I don't always stand up when I'm asked to stand up. I don't always say the things maybe that I ought to say when I'm asked to say those things. I maybe couch them in very mellow terms, in very mild terms, rather than standing up and saying what the Spirit has really told me to say. Rather than speaking with clarity, sometimes I try to play the neutral game. I don't know. Maybe you guys are... Maybe you don't relate to Peter. Maybe you don't relate to me on that either. But that is the tragedy of the trial. It's not the beatings. It's not the spitting in his face. It's not the ropes that bound him. It's not the words that the accusers said. It's not the way that Caiaphas treated him, or the way that Pilate treated him, or even King Herod treated him. It was the way that his own, his closest, the ones that he walked with, the ones that he taught, the ones he prayed with, the ones he ate with, those were the ones. It's when Peter denied his Lord that Jesus really cried out in his heart. He said, Lord, they're all forsaking me. I'm alone now. Everyone who claims a relationship with Jesus, but who denies him by the life they live, is still guilty of spitting in his face. So, what will you choose? Two questions become evident as we study the trial of Jesus and those who surrounded Jesus in that trial. I'll leave you with these two questions. There's the question of desires. The question of desires. What type of life do you want to live? Do you want to live a life full of pleasure and gratification? An out-of-control life? A life where you do whatever you want to do, regardless of the consequences? That life will have to be lived separate from Jesus Christ. Or, do you want to live a life full of blessings? A life that is connected with God's will? A life where there's a plan for you, for your future. A life that's filled with the power of God. A life that is peaceful. A life that is contented. A life full of hope. Then that would be a life connected to Jesus Christ. I guess that's your decision. What will be your answer?